Flying cars and a stranded cosmonaut. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Jetsons flying car could soon become a reality. NASA is working on a project involving flying vehicles that can transport people and goods almost like an air taxi. We'll speak with Nancy Bukeski about how flying cars could impact our future. Then, a revisit with Lance Bass, NSYNC superstar and host of the podcast The Last Soviet. We'll chat with him about cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's experience of being stranded in space for 313 days. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Flying cars could soon be soaring in our skies. NASA is working on new technology that will create a new mode of transportation in our skies with air taxis. The goal is for these air taxis to be easily accessible for people to travel in, and NASA is working on a way for users to call the vehicle from a hub, possibly with an app on their phone. Nancy Bukeski is the chief engineer for integration of automated systems under NASA and spoke with Are We There Yet's Marion Summerall about the development of this new technology.
Nancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's talk about what an air taxi is.
Sure. So the idea is that NASA is working with all parts of industry to advance the research in something called urban air mobility, as well as regional air mobility and the broader sense of advanced air mobility. Urban air mobility would be where the air taxis fit in. The idea being that, you know, right now we're able to use basically planes, trains, and automobiles to get places, right? And locally within urban areas, we can maybe use, current taxis, such as what's in New York City and other big cities, or now with Uber and Lyft, we're able to use our phones to call up a ride from anywhere we are to anywhere that they're willing to go, right? So the idea being that eventually we could maybe even do something similar where it's an app on our phone where we call up an air taxi. Now, it's probably not going to show up in our backyard and take us to exactly our friend's house across town. But the idea being, you know, as if you live in an urban area, say the city is gridlocked and you're trying to get across town for an important appointment, or there needs to be, you know, you could even use it for transporting organs in life and death situations, where the idea is you're circumventing any of the downsides to being on the ground and getting to go from one place to another in a more efficient manner. And so how this would probably work is there will eventually be something maybe called a vertiport, where there will be hubs that we can go to. So maybe, like I said, it's probably not going to show up in my backyard, but I might be able to drive 5 or 10 minutes down the road and take an air taxi to a vertiport, say, so I live in Connecticut, maybe it's down in New York City, where maybe it takes me 20 minutes to get down there, and then I call an Uber on the ground to get me to my final location at that point. So that's how we're envisioning what an air taxi might look like. Obviously, we have a long way to go, so it might look very different once we get to that point.
Who is working on this with your team? Is it just NASA? Do you guys have other connections? And how involved are you on the project as well?
So there are all parts of NASA working various aspects of that of this, and there are many different partnerships currently in the works with multiple vehicle manufacturers, as well as FAA and other parts of industry. To really, what NASA is trying to do is further the research and make sure that things are, you know, all aspects are considered to include community. So the idea that maybe there could be hundreds of these air taxis out there, frankly, as a citizen, I'm thinking, well, is my yard going to be loud when I'm sitting out there, right? So different parts of NASA are working: acoustics, automation, looking into what it would take to get certified, all those different types of things. So specifically, the project that I'm working on, Integration of Automated Systems, or IAS, we're partnered with Sikorsky and DARPA right now, leveraging kind of an ecosystem that DARPA and Sikorsky have developed over many years, where Sikorsky has two helicopters. One is called OPV, one is called Sarah, where they have the ability to take our software that we're developing on the NASA side, put it on their aircraft, and if it doesn't work the way it's supposed to, they can easily go back to the helicopter that is already certified and is the flight characteristics are known. So that's a huge advantage for NASA, because we can be developing our software, We don't have to go through years of certification and testing just to see if certain aspects are going to work. The software we're working on isn't something that's going to be ready to put on any vehicle. We're looking at different concepts. So specifically vehicle automation in choreographing, if you will, exactly where each aircraft is going to be at any given time. So if you can imagine multiple, maybe even hundreds of air taxis in the air, it wouldn't be possible the current way that we fly for any system or any pilot to be able to, any one pilot to be able to keep track of everything that's going on, both now, you know, just a few hundred feet in front of them, as well as miles ahead. So right now, aircraft are equipped with things like radar, where they can either, the aircraft is equipped or the FAA controllers are able to point out other aircraft that might be in conflict. This is beyond that. It's communicating the intent of that aircraft. So not only where am I now, but where am I going to be a second from now, 8 seconds from now, exactly. So a very specific latitude, longitude, altitude, and time. And so we're working with various entities in NASA to develop that research so that we can see how accurately can we be in, you know, on that 4D trajectory. How accurately can we ingest that intent from another similarly equipped aircraft? What we're working on is helping to advance the research of vehicle automation, where an aircraft will be at a specific point in space as well as time. So very specific, what we're calling four-dimensional trajectories or 4DTs. The idea being that if everybody is eventually equipped with this type of automation, my aircraft can be looking at all the other aircraft's intent and knowing, oh, you're planning to be here at any given time. I'm planning to be here. I see a conflict 5 minutes down the way. If one or both of us makes a small correction, we can, you know, deconflict from each other, but still get to our endpoint at a very specific time. So those vertiports can have predictability of people coming in and leaving. So that's the type of research that we're doing. And we've been able to work with Sikorsky over the last year and a half in testing out some of that with very scripted maneuvers of the two aircraft flying at each other, not necessarily close in, but we're able to test out that automation and see if that intent can be passed, see if the NASA algorithms can deconflict and then reroute the aircraft, but stay on its planned trajectory as far as time and distance or time and location in the future. So that's really what we've been working on. And it's been very much a build-up approach to get to where we are. With more aircraft in the air, it's going to have to constantly, the algorithm is going to constantly be updating, identifying new conflicts and rerouting around them. And so that's more of the strategic side. The tactical side of the algorithms that we're working on are also, if all else fails or other aircraft aren't similarly equipped, if we get to within a closer tactical position, meaning you know, you're talking maybe a minute or less in front of you versus 5, 10, 20 minutes from where you are, having other algorithms that help you deconflict in a quicker manner, meaning maybe my time to get to the vertiport is less important than this conflict that's there in front of me, and I might have to reroute around them and then ask for permission, if you will, at the vertiport to be maybe a minute or two past my arrival time. So, and all of that, the idea would be it's happening, you know, through automation. So it's not necessarily a pilot calling up the vertiport and saying, I'm going to be 2 minutes late. It's that the software sends to the vertiport, hey, this aircraft is now going to miss its required time of arrival by 2 minutes. How do you want us to proceed? Do we have to delay? Is 2 minutes okay? Or do we need to divert to somewhere else? So again, this is all how we're picturing it. It may look very different from this. There's still a lot of research to be had.
How will this kind of change our day-to-day lives? I know we kind of hit on it a little bit in the beginning, but are we not going to need as many pilots anymore? Or are they still a huge part in these air taxis?
Yeah. So again, I think that, you know, the research that we're doing is really platform agnostic and pilot sitting somewhere agnostic. So the pilot could be on board, they could be at a remote location, you know, controlling the vehicles from afar kind of thing. I think all of that is within the realm of possible. I see, you know, one of the things, so I'm a general aviation pilot myself, I'm a helicopter pilot. And so, of course, I don't want that ability to go away. So I can definitely see where other general aviation pilots would might be concerned that this could eventually negatively impact the ability to just go out and fly the way we know it. The way I look at it is, you know, when the Wright brothers first started flying and that turned into, you know, people going around just figuring out how to get airborne. Eventually, the FAA had to be established and rules had to be established. And so it just, you know, it things sort of just progressed to get us to where we are now. That didn't necessarily keep anybody from doing something. It just maybe required some different rules to be in place. So that's kind of where I see the air taxis going, is wherever they end up operating, whatever, you know, altitude of airspace, whatever areas over cities or not, is all going to depend on, you know, kind of how things evolve. I think it'll start with, you know, onesie twosie vehicle manufacturers trying to figure out how to begin to make some money out of this. So maybe there will be some niche markets that probably will be more expensive than most of us are willing to pay. But one of the pushes of NASA is to make sure that this stays open to all of the public. I mean, right now, rich people can, you know, charter their own aircraft and get from, like I said, Connecticut to New York City pretty easily without having to worry so much about cost. For the rest of us, sure, it's probably going to be more expensive than calling an Uber to go across town. But it might, you know, the idea is it's still within reach of most of us, where if it's something that benefits us, we'll be able to use it. As far as uses, I mean, I could imagine many different uses besides just convenience, you know, the transporting of organs. I could even see in rural areas where nonprofits are trying to get medicine to, you know, people that don't have access to good roads and stuff like that. I think that there will be all sorts of opportunities for this, especially if we can have at least some of them where they're uncrewed and, you know, we don't need as many pilots, maybe in remote locations and places where, you know, it might be harder to entice people to go work and stuff. I think that that type of automation could really open up some opportunities to get healthcare and, you know, medical supplies and other types of supplies to very remote locations across the world. So I think that beyond just, you know, convenience for people like you and me, this could really give nonprofits, you know, some additional resources to really, you know, further their own missions to help others. So I think that, you know, we could probably sit here and come up with 10 or 20 different ways that we might use these, and we might be wrong. I mean, 20 years from now, when these things start to become, you know, more ubiquitous, and that 20 years is a total guess. I have no idea how long it's going to take. But, you know, when we start to see these things being more common, we'll probably chuckle at whatever our assumptions are now, right? Because we're just trying to keep the ball rolling and moving that ball down the field kind of thing to try to see where this goes and figure out what are the unintended consequences? How do we manage those? What are some of the areas, the opportunities that we didn't foresee that might be a great addition to what might be possible? So I think we're going to see a lot of different uses.
You know, Nancy, I appreciate you so much for coming on the show. Thank you for being here.
Absolutely.
Still to come.
I just thought it was so fascinating to hear about life before the ISS, you know, the mirror days, mm-hmm. the small stations. And I had never heard about Krekalev's story, especially being stranded in space 313 days in the fall of communism in the Soviet Union. It was such an insane time, and how his patriotism took over. And he might not agree with half of what his country is doing, but as a patriot, just stayed up there and decided to man the last, you know, outpost for his country.
A glimpse into the life of a cosmonaut stranded in space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The podcast The Last Soviet tells the story of cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's 313 days stranded in space when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. We're revisiting a conversation with Lance Bass. Yes, that Lance Bass from NSYNC. He's also the host of that podcast, The Last Soviet, and he joins us now to talk about how he stumbled upon Krikalev's story. We also talk about Bass's own training for a private space mission. Lance, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, Lance, the podcast is called The Last Soviet. It chronicles cosmonaut Sergei Krikalev's 313 days stranded in space after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. Lance, first of all, where did you come across this story? It's so fascinating.
Well, originally I heard this story when I was training over in Russia. I was so fascinated with other cosmonauts because, of course, in America, we learn all about our Apollo astronauts, but didn't get too much on Yuri Gagarin and all these other famous cosmonauts that they had. So learning about these guys, especially from the guys who put them in space, because no one has really left Star City. It's the same people that put Gagarin up are pretty much there today. Even Sergei is there, you know, one of the heads of Russian, you know, space program. So, you know, just talking about Gagarin and all these other ones, this is one of the stories that I was told because Sergei was working on the military base. And I just thought it was so fascinating to hear about life before the ISS, you know, the Mir days, mm-hmm. the small stations. And I had never heard about Krikalev's story, especially being stranded in space 313 days in the fall of communism and Soviet Union. It was such an insane time, and how his patriotism took over, and he might not agree with half of what his country is doing, but as a patriot, just stayed up there and decided to man the last, you know, outpost for his country.
You know, you the story happened in 91. You came across it when you were training some two decades ago. Why is it relevant now? Why is it important to hear this story now?
Well, I think it's relevant to hear stories like this because, you know, space has always been about politics. And a lot of people don't really realize that. You know, we get caught up in the whole patriotism of it all and the exploration, and even the cosmonauts and the astronauts, they have the love of space. They're going to do their job and they don't really get into the politics of it all. But they've always been used by their governments, you know, with politics always being, you know, the puppet of it all. Mm-hmm. So it's nice to understand this history and see how it unfolded, especially in a time of the fall of the Soviet Union that we all think we know what happened. But to see it from the eyes of everyone that lived it, especially from the space program and especially from a cosmonaut that was, you know, lied to himself, mm-hmm. you know, half the time he was up there, he didn't know what was happening. The only way that he knew the real news was from a girl in Australia that he would connect with on the ham radio that his country didn't even know he was talking to. So he was getting all this, you know, side information of what was going on, not knowing what was happening with his family down there on Earth, and especially his just few-month-old baby.
Mm-hmm. That's the fascinating part of this story, is how he maintained that connection to Earth despite, you know, that ham radio is absolutely bonkers, that's how he stayed connected, right?
I mean, you have to do something. I mean, look, the ISS is a grand hotel compared to what he experienced. Yeah. So, and I'm glad that he was able to get to the ISS. He was the first one on there. So, like, I'm so glad that he got to do both. Uh-huh. But there is a serious thing called space madness, you know, and you will go crazy in space, especially with, you know, no one to really talk to, just doing your daily duties every single day. Has got to be so monotonous. So having that outlet to be able to talk to someone that you eventually considered a friend, to kind of catch you up on life and what it's like down there, it's the only thing that kept him sane.
Mm-hmm. Lance, I've had a chance to talk to a lot of U.S. astronauts, so it's interesting to hear your perspective talking about cosmonauts. But as you alluded to earlier in our conversation, it does seem like that, you know, space kind of transcends politics and boundaries down here on Earth. Is that the sense you got when you were training in the early 2000s?
Yes. I loved the camaraderie between Russia and America in the space programs. everyone just respects each other and they do stay out of the politics of it all. And, you know, it's the only thing that we have that I feel like the Earth is in it together. You know, we all want to advance our planet together by experimenting in space, exploring space. The ISS, how many countries have come together on this one little bitty, you know, machine. But we're all doing it for one reason, to make sure that everyone on Earth advances in a better way. It's not just for the countries. Everything we discover as America or Russia discovers for Russia, it's all going to be shared at some point. And it's just really just bettered our planet as a whole. And it's not, there are no borders in space, at least for now.
Yeah. Lance, let's go back to when you were training there in 2002. Why the heck did you want to leave the planet in the first place? What was your motivation to take on this mission?
Exploration. I think maybe watching Indiana Jones a few times made me that just the excitement of discovery has always been with me since a little kid. And there was always space around me. So my grandfather loved space. My dad, my great uncle, who was, you know, an amazing World War II pilot, who lived at Merritt Island right next to Cape Canaveral. They've always been fascinated with it, and they kind of rubbed off on me. So watching movies like Space Camp, even weirdly enough, growing up on Nickelodeon and watching Double Dare, and the winner would go to Space Camp, and I'd always dream, like, I want to go to Space Camp. They would show all this amazing footage of these kids having the best time. And so I eventually went to Space Camp. Finally, my dad took me down to Cape Canaveral. I saw my first launch. And seeing that just really solidified my love for space and just going somewhere that most men do not get to go. I want to be that person. So I knew then that was my path. And I found out I had to, you know, become a space engineer first, and then maybe you would be able to get into an astronaut class. So, you know, I had the right path in mind. And then all of a sudden NSYNC just kind of landed in my lap. Like, okay, I guess we'll go on this path instead.
I'm glad you mentioned the movie Space Camp, because that was one of my favorite growing up, and I feel like that's a very underrated movie, but it seems like that's a through line from a lot of people that do have a passion for space. So you did NSYNC, but you also had the chance to train on this mission. Lance, you trained in a Soyuz capsule. That was going to be your trip up to space. I've seen pictures of a Soyuz capsule. It does not look comfortable at all. what was it like sitting in one of those things?
It's miserable. And even my mock missions, I didn't even have my bundles of clothes and everything. That makes it even tighter. But you get to know your crew very well. You're on top of them. Most people don't understand that your knees are in your chest. You're in a ball, but you're there for hours. And so after a few minutes, your body just goes dead from waist down. So you can't feel a thing. And you know, you're having little rods that you're having to push buttons, and it's intense, because you know my training was condensed into a very short 6-month training, which should take years. And it's not like the shuttle where you can sit in a seat and be like, oh, I can just be a tourist and this is great. No, you actually had things you had to do that would, you know, save your crew's life. So, you know, I was in charge of oxygen and that type of stuff. So you had to really know what you were doing so that you don't kill your crew. But it is not a fun flight. You definitely do it for the love of it. And a lot of people don't understand too is, yeah, it's like you shoot up to space, you're great, but no, you still have 2 days to get to the ISS, chasing that ISS in this very small, they call it the BO. And you're just sitting there with your crew doing, you know, if you can have some experiments you can do in that 2 days, great. But most of the time you're sitting there bored as hell, holding the bathroom from one of your crew members.
That does not sound very fun at all. Lance, I mean, 20 years ago, you were kind of blazing a new path with this private space mission. But since then, these private space missions are they're happening more frequently with the likes of SpaceX. Do you ever think that you'll try again? Is space in your future?
Yeah, I mean, I think space is in everyone's future. I love what they're doing with privatizing space. It only advances us quicker, especially for experiments and, you know, not having to wait for space on the ISS or the Soyuz, which is, there's a long line to get up to the ISS. But with these other, you know, rockets going off, it's great. We can get to our experiments a lot quicker. And for a lot of people, just to go up to space and float around, that's good enough for them. It's a great roller coaster. That was never my want. I don't think I would ever go with Virgin or anything like that. I mean, unless someone just gave me a ticket to go, sure. But I don't think I would ever pay to go. You know, my dream is still to, I mean, obviously my experiments are very dated, so I would have to choose something different. But my dream is to, you know, get a company behind me that needs to send an astronaut to space to do their experiments. You know, I was doing blood studies and environmental studies on the ISS, lived there for 10 days. And, you know, I wanted to do something that meant something, and advances. I wasn't there just to kind of float around and take pictures for Instagram.
Well, Lance, if you want to do another podcast in space and you need a podcast producer, please feel free to reach out to me. More than happy to help.
First time in space, yes.
But and finally, Lance, with your podcast, The Last Soviet, what do you want listeners to take away from this?
I love history, and we learn so much when we don't just study our country's history. This really gives some great history of a country we probably don't know much about and have really been told to hate. So from the angle of a cosmonaut who just wants to do the right thing and help this planet, it's a very interesting story to see how we all work together and how countries really do come together to help everyone on this planet. But also how politics play a huge, huge role in all of space exploration. You know, the cosmonauts might not get into it, but the governments are definitely using these cosmonauts and astronauts as a political pawn in many, many ways. So, you know, and the thing that sucks with this one, we had Sergei Korolev, who is very active and one of the heads of the space program now. He was going to be a part of this podcast and he was excited about it, but because of the war, of course, Russia's not allowing him to do any interviews with any American, you know, podcaster. So unfortunately, we do not get to get a brand new interview with him. But what's great about this is we interview all of his friends, all of his colleagues. So you really get to see, like, see and hear what was in his head. And it's a beautiful podcast, the way that they bring in the sound effects. And it's one that you want to, I would suggest, you know, if you're in your car driving to work, great, but in the end of the night when you're ready to go to bed, put those headphones on and just kind of immerse yourself in this beautiful world that they've created with The Last Soviet.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Bonaiuto. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.